What's up? This is Gareth Emery, and you are listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine, coming at you live and direct from quarantine. We're back at it with another video chat interview with, this time it's with Gareth Emery. I'm sure some of you know Gareth and love what he does. Some of you may not be so familiar. Gareth is a British trance god. He's been ranked as high as number 7 on the DJ Mag Top 100 DJs poll. He's had a State of Trance Tune of the Year award for his track You back in 2014. This man is busy. He's got his own label, Garuda Records, where he puts out his own music as well as developing a number of other artists. He used to have the Gareth Emery podcast. He's got his radio show. Dude is, he's doing it. And I love this episode. We get some great nuggets of wisdom. He tells us the story of almost giving up after some early success. It wasn't happening for him. He was close to shutting it all down and go get a day job, whatever. He got some important words of wisdom from his father, gave himself 6 months to turn it all around, and he kind of walks us through what that was like and what he did, and there's some stuff we can all learn from there. And he's got some just great words about a consistent work ethic. We talk about the concept of compounding interest and how that applies not just in finance but in life and in putting into work and everything we do. We're also going to use this episode to introduce a new co-host, my man Ethan Baer, who is the head of electronic music at Create Music Group, one of my go-to experts for everything that's happening in electronic music today. He co-hosts with me, and he's you'll probably hear some more of Ethan as we go throughout the summer and maybe even beyond that. So let's get into it right now with Gareth Emery. Well, hey man, thanks for doing this. I'm excited to meet you. I know you guys know each other and you know, been following your career a little bit from afar, and so I'm excited to dig into some of it with you. I appreciate you you making time for us.
Super happy to be here. I appreciate the social interaction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very much so.
Well, Gareth, there's lots of exciting stuff to talk about as far as your career. I always like to kind of go back to the beginning. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
Yeah, it's an embarrassing one though, because it's not dance music.
Good.
It was by an American hair metal band called Poison.
Oh shit.
Yeah, you remember them?
So
and the record was called Your Mama Don't Dance. And it was on a 12-inch vinyl, probably a 7-inch single and a vinyl single, and I remember my mum bought it for me. And then after that, yeah, I didn't then buy another one for about probably 11 or 12 years until I got into dance music and started buying that. But yeah, that was the first one.
Well, I think definitely starting with a Poison record will put you off music for a while.
Yes.
And
it certainly meant that my first dance music single was like a big step up from my
walking before. For sure. So I went to an event, when was it? November, and the Bret Michaels band was playing. And so he can't use the Poison name. But he performs all Poison songs, and it was the best worst show I've ever seen. I mean, like the music was absolutely atrocious, and they played Poison songs and they played other, you know, classic rock covers. But the stage presence, and you know, it was like a corporate gig. He'd gotten a lot of money for him, you know, to play this show, and he was like so gracious and really working the crowd, and it was like a case study in, you know, in maybe how not to end up or in how to do it if you've ended up in that situation.
Can I ask what corporate event?
Oh, so So it was so you know, every year we have the LA Auto Show, you know, which is a huge event for the automotive industry and the car companies. A couple of them do parties at night for the trade. And so I always get invited to the Hyundai party, and they have really interesting talent. That, you know, I've been there for Kool and the Gang. I've been there for Jeff Bridges, like some really kind of cool off the wall stuff. And then like the Bret Michaels band and some other stuff that you wouldn't want to have to sit through for too long. But, you know, that's
really watching AB that's been doing it live for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
And I actually think you pick up much more tricks from somebody like that who's been on the road for like, you know, 30 or 40 years than you necessarily do from somebody like hot and new and everything's easy for them. Whereas those ones that have been doing it and they've done the arenas and now they're doing corporate gigs, like there's no sort of show they haven't seen and there's no sort of audience they haven't learned how to deal with. So it's there's good stuff to learn there.
There definitely is. You know, it's funny, I was at the first Coachella and I was hanging out backstage and I met somebody that worked on the crew. I forget what artist they were with, but I started talking to the person and it was like production manager. They were saying they usually tour with Natalie Cole. And I was like, well, what's that like? And he's like, it's the easiest job. We've been working together, all of us, for 20 years. We're like a family. You know, we stay in Ritz-Carlton's, we play really nice venues. He's like, it's just an amazing thing that we have going. And then he was at Coachella and just like totally out of sorts and, you know, had never been to that type of festival before or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, you know, from where I come from, like touring is hard work. It's late nights. It's, you know, you're grinding out flights one after the other. And that guy had a totally different perspective on it. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, over the years you figure it out, right? And you get your system and your people. I'm sure you must have some of that by now as well.
It's easier than it used to be.
Yeah.
I also make it harder for myself by always trying to sort of go bigger each year and trying to find stuff that I haven't done before. And it would be easier in some ways to just settle into a routine and go, that's what we do, let's just do that. We've got the people, we know the venues. But I'm always liking to try new shit, and which does make it more difficult because you're, even if you're with the same people, you're trying to do things you haven't done before. But it is nice when you do like a long tour and it's all the same. And when you get to the end, you're kind of like, oh, you know exactly every night works. You show up last minute. There's no worries about the performance. And man, in the early days, I'm so nervous, but yeah.
Let me talk to you real quick about Raycon earbuds. I feel like earbuds are so important now to our daily lives. I have mine in pretty much all day long because I might be on the phone, listening to music, podcasts, audiobooks, whatever I'm doing, I have my earbuds in. I need good sound. I need long battery life. I need a comfortable fit. And, you know, and I've gone through a lot of different products to find the ones that best meet my needs. Raycon makes a great pair of earbuds. The Everyday E25 is their best ones yet. Over 6 hours of playtime. It's easy to pair with your phone. They look good, they sound good, they feel good. That's what's up. You know, it's called Raycon. It's founded by Ray J. You know, if they're good enough for Ray J, they're probably good enough for you. So give them a try. See how you like them. Now's the time to get your latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your first order at buyraycon.com/rebel. That's buyraycon.com/rebel for 15% off Raycon wireless earbuds. buyraycon.com/rebel. You know, tell us about the We'll Be Okay, kind of how that come together and how it's played out.
Yeah, so I mean, the song You'll Be Okay was not written about anything that what's going on at the moment. It was written while I was on a plane I thought was going to crash, basically.
Oh, wow.
It was, yeah. There were two separate incidents. Like, I've had two pretty scary. Well, one was a full emergency landing. Another was like a private jet that filled with smoke. And basically, the song was kind of a letter to my wife from those perspectives. And then we're getting ready to release it, and obviously all this sort of coronavirus shit's going on. And I was kind of thinking, oh man, it's like kind of a bad time to be releasing this song right now. And then, yeah, bad time to be announcing a new album. But then when we put it out, it just had the most amazing reaction as people kind of took the song. Yeah, I guess people sort of took the song and took the message, you'll be okay, and sort of applied it to themselves, right? You know, a lot of people going through like a pretty fucking tough time right now, you know, like me included. So, and then that kind of morphed into We'll Be Okay. It was began as like a t-shirt we put out and people really, you know, jumped on it. And then we're like, fuck it, let's make it into like a little music video for the acoustic version of You'll Be Okay. I think the thing right now is like almost any content that we planned prior to this stuff all happening has just become kind of a wash.
Sure.
Because anything related to the current crisis that's kind of honest and genuine, people are really relating to, and anything that's like was made 2 months ago, forget it. Not interesting. So we're kind of fortunate, and we had some music that we were able to kind of bend to that purpose.
Sure.
My better stuff has always been the more like emotional, play at your wedding or your funeral type of thing.
Have you DJed a funeral?
No. I might DJ my own, make a little play.
I feel like that would be a tough crowd.
Would be a tough crowd. Yeah, they wouldn't be much raging.
Yeah, you can't. No. It's hard to get people dancing at a funeral.
Yeah.
So, not to segue on the down note, but I know you've been through some tough times before. You know, I've seen you talk about kind of almost, you went through a dry spell. What was it, 2006?
2006, yeah.
And almost gave up and didn't, thankfully. Yeah. Talk to us about that. How, well, I guess one question maybe is what did you learn then that you're using now?
Well, what I certainly learned then and in the years that come is it's always going to be fucking hard. I probably had a preconception at some point then that like now it's hard, but when I've made it, it'll be easy because it certainly isn't. Yeah. Don't get any easier. Yeah. It gets more enjoyable in many ways and more rewarding, but certainly not easier. Yeah, so what happened in that time was when I signed my first record in 2002 and things happened really fast. So within 12 months, I had played every major UK super club. These are places I've been going to for like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
I'd had records on a Tiesto CD. I'd made one of the biggest trance tracks of the year. Like stuff I thought that would take me 5 years to accomplish, I'd done in 12 months.
Wow.
And when you're young and there's hype on you, and I was like 20, 22, 23 at the time, everything is a little bit easy. So I was getting written about in like magazines like Mixed Mag and stuff that I really had no business being written about in because I hadn't done much. But fuck it, I hype, right?
Yeah.
Take it. The issue was the record I made was a bit of a fluke and I was not able to follow it up.
Yeah.
And that was a major, major issue. And it took me probably close to 5 years until I made something as good. So what happened was, and it's very common for artists, I made this one record, I blew up and doing loads of gigs. And then all of a sudden I got loads of other stuff to do. I'm traveling, I've got a website to maintain, I've got like fans as it were. And I took my eye off the ball when it came to making music.
Right.
So my musical output dropped. For a year or two, that's fine. Like things don't move that quickly. But then like 2 years down the line, all of a sudden those prime slots that I was getting are going to other people and the gigs and the gigs are drying up. And that's a big fucking problem. And 2006 is where things really reached a peak. First 3 months of the year, didn't do a single gig, not a single professional engagement. And like, there wasn't a global pandemic in 2006. Right. There was just nobody wanted to fucking book me.
Yeah.
So I started to think, you know what, I made this one hit in 2002. I haven't been able to follow it up. And every time I looked online, like, nobody really was talking about me, but those that were was like, he should just give up. That he's a one hit wonder. He ain't never following up Mistral.
Sure.
And like, yeah, my friends as well. Like, I remember a really good mate of mine. I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, well, you're 25 years old. He said, you still live with your parents. He said, you're a really good DJ. He goes, but I'd think about getting a job. So I applied for jobs. I looked at, I talked to friends that worked in banks, and I was like, listen, can you get me in? I was genuinely looking at getting out of the game and starting full-time work. It was a fucking tough period. And the one person that kind of pulled me back was my dad, which he's never been like somebody that got involved in my career or kind of like acted as like an inspirational character or anything. But when I told him I was giving up, he was like, he said, you haven't really tried, have you? And I was furious. I was like, fuck you, I've tried so hard. I spend 18 hours in front of the computer every day. And he goes, yeah, you do. He said, you spend 18 hours in front of the computer watching porn and chatting to your mates on MSN Messenger.
Isn't that part of the job?
Right. Well, I thought it was at the time. And I was livid with his assessment, but actually he was right. And in the end, I said, you know what, I'm going to give this 6 months.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try and see if I could turn things around. And, you know, you're not going to turn it around entirely in 6 months, but I was able to change things enough that after 6 months, I could see there was at least progress. I was getting somewhere. I was able to make one track that didn't beat my hit, but it kind of got close to it. I started a podcast, which I ended up running for 10 years. Or 11 years.
Yeah.
And they're not kind of on the right track, and it was just a case of adding to it. But that period has kind of meant I'm much less likely to like let my guard down and rest on my laurels now, because I kind of know where that ends up. And I've seen it happen to a lot of friends as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, too much success too soon is a really bad thing when you look at, you know, the history of musicians certainly and creative people in general. And I think especially at that age, right, it's hard to see. I mean, now you can look at, you know, you can look at a career and see the ups and downs and kind of, you know, hopefully have some perspective that's part of it, right? But at 25, that's really hard.
Right, exactly. And reading what people are saying about you on the internet, I've got better at learning that, but it was kind of the first time where I was able to read what a large audience thought about me.
Yeah.
And it was not particularly good. I think also, like, when you get success and you know you're a little bit lucky in getting that success, you don't necessarily have confidence that it's repeatable.
Sure, and, of course.
And, you know, it'll be the same, and the same things apply to me now, but for different stuff, right? So if one of the records on my new album ends up, you know, being my biggest one yet, I'll be like, how do I repeat that? Every time something happens that you haven't done before, you're like, shit, was that luck, or can I repeat it?
Right.
Then once you've repeated something two or three times, you're like, yeah, okay, I've got this, I can do it. But always punching to that next level is where the challenge is.
So in that 6 months, you know, after you talked with your dad, what'd you do differently?
I think the one biggest thing that kind of changed the game for me was starting a podcast, funny enough. And this was very early in the day of music podcasts. There were just none around it. Like, podcasting, I think there'd been podcasts on the iTunes store for a little while, but really not that long. And there were like one or two podcasts out there.
Sure.
And nobody was trying to do them because podcasts weren't where the listeners were. Mm-hmm. The listeners were in radio. And I kind of thought, no point starting like a traditional streaming radio, because that's where all the other artists are. Where are the other DJs? Where are people not? They're not in podcasts.
Yeah.
And just having a project that I could do every couple of weeks, like making my podcast, just gave me something to work on. And sometimes that's all you need. Yeah. You need something. And because I was starting with a new medium, podcasting, it didn't matter if I wasn't getting a lot of listeners, right? My first audience, probably like 5 or 10 people, and that was completely fine. It just gave me something to work on every 2 weeks. And I think having something regular and scheduled you do in these kind of tough periods is really, really helpful. And then that meant, as I built up the listeners, I was like, hey, you know, let's make some music that I can play it on the podcast. And so I started to make music for it. And then I started doing events, right? So the next year we did Gareth Emery's Podcast Party, I think it was called, and we did like 200 tickets in London. And that started a kind of chain of throwing my own events if a promoter wouldn't give me, you know, the venue that I wanted. And yeah, that took us all the way up to doing, you know, 8,500 people in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
So
it's brilliant.
Yes. So, and I've retired the podcast in 2017 after I think 11 years, just because I wanted to spend more time on music, and it had served its purpose and everyone else was doing them. So I didn't feel the need to have a music podcast out there.
Sure.
But yeah, that show really changed everything. Firstly, because I was a little bit early, and secondly, because just gave me some structure in my life, I think.
No, that's,
I think,
brilliant.
Maybe it's fair to say that some of that, you were saying before that sometimes it's hard to feel confident about your work when you're not sure if it was luck or if it's repeatable.
Yeah.
Do you think the fact that you worked on that podcast every week and you proved to yourself that it was repeatable and it was something that you could consistently deliver, do you think that that helped build up that confidence? Like, do you think the show kind of helped like play a role in that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other really good thing about the show is, and I think this can be applied to a lot of things, having some low stakes media to work on is really helpful. Because otherwise I was putting so much pressure on myself that every time I got in the studio, I was like, I've got to be Mistral, which was my hit from like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that put so much pressure on every studio session, it meant I would have never done it. Now, the podcast was low stakes, and that was fun. And it eventually did become a bit higher stakes. But having some low stakes media like I had fun with and nobody else really gave a shit about, that was very, very helpful.
Right. It was good for like setting the small achievable goals, so you felt like you were consistently making progress.
Right, exactly. If I can tick off a podcast and I can do that every fortnight or every 52 weeks of the year or whatever, it's progress, right? One step at a time. And I think in our world of shortcuts, one thing that is greatly underestimated, at least amongst the public at large, is just the compounding of small sort of winnable goals on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that saying of like,
absolutely.
80% of the job is just showing up. It's like, if you just keep showing up, it builds on itself.
No, it really is. And I can sort of analyze what I've done that's worked, you know, over and over again. But like, honestly, probably the biggest factor in having a successful career is that there's not been a single day in the last 20 years when I haven't at some point worked on DJ Gareth Emery, that particular project. Like, I've done something towards that. Most days it's been a lot, some days it's been a little, but there's not been a single day when I haven't thought about it in the last 2 decades, and that compounds over time.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I totally get that, and I appreciate that story. You know, definitely for me, even starting this show, if you know, we go back even in the first episode, I said, you know, our motto is low expectations. Because I think, you know, because we just wanted to do it for fun. And if no one listens, then we're still having fun. And if a lot of people love it, then that's great too. But I think, you know, we don't get a lot of opportunities, especially the more successful you become, to do things with low stakes, right? So, you know, I feel like sometimes you have to create those, and you have to build in ways to not worry about the outcome.
Yeah, and I still do that now. I mean, in the studio, And I struggled with this for many, many years. It was always high stakes going in the studio.
Yeah.
And the only way I could beat that was just showing up every day. And it didn't need to be for a long time. 2 hours, fine. But I, over the last 18 months or so, I would record every time. And I still do. Every time I go in the studio, I log my hours in the studio.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, yeah. And I have a pretty modest target, right? My target is like, I think, about 10 hours a week. I'll often do more, but like 2 hours a day, 25 days a week. If I do that, I'll be very, very productive. And firstly, just by recording it means that I don't guess how much time I'm spending in the studio. I know I'd have to open my phone. I can tell you exactly how long I've spent in the studio. So it means I probably do more. Secondly, it makes me show up every day.
Yeah.
And that puts a lot less pressure on any individual session because there's no demand to write a hit. I just do whatever comes naturally because I'll be back again the next day. Right. And it's been very helpful in removing the pressure just by logging it.
Consistency helps lower the stakes.
It really does. When it's like, and before, this is how it would be for me. I'd be playing Ultra Music in fucking 2 months or whatever. I'd go in the studio and I'd be thinking, I've got to make a fucking smash for Ultra Music. And that level of pressure does not always equal sort of great creative outcomes.
Yeah.
But I've also been doing, like, funny enough, like my low stakes pursuit right now is doing video edits. Never really done those before. Got a bit of time on my hands. So I've been learning Final Cut and editing my own videos. And like on one level, you know, it's a great skill to get good at, but it's also low stakes because like if I can't figure it out, I can just fucking pass it on to somebody else. And I don't actually need to do it. So it's been fun.
That's great. So what about, you know, thinking about the time in 06, you know, there are some people who should give up.
Right. That's,
right. And I mean, you know, that's just the reality, right? Like not everyone is going to be successful in music or in any endeavor. You know, some people have big dreams and they're not going to be able to make it happen. So, you know, having gone through what you went through, how would you advise somebody that's kind of wrestling with those same questions?
It's incredibly difficult. And you've kind of got the nail on the head there of one of the hardest things for me to get my head around. And it's this, right? And let me use a story to illustrate it. So actor called Mark Ruffalo, pretty famous now, Hollywood actor. And he apparently attended something like 600 auditions before he got his first role.
Wow.
And he used to be a barman at, I think, the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. 600 auditions until he got a role. And then once he got his foot in the door, became very, very successful. And many people liked him and enjoyed his work.
Sure.
So I'm sure at like audition 598, nobody really believed in him. And he knew he had it and he just carried on going. However, there's also lots of people like Mark Ruffalo who are on audition 600 and they're never going to get the job.
Millions.
Just because they're not good enough.
Yeah, most people.
Most people. And unfortunately, there is no way of knowing. And I kind of think that there's a very thin line between somebody that always knew they were good, whether it was they were a good DJ, they were a good actor, they had a good business idea, and just carrying on planning on even when the whole world said no to them. And there's a very thin line between them and somebody that's actually just fucking nuts.
It's the fine line between grandeur and delusions of grandeur.
Exactly. And I can't even call that where that line is. And I've seen people plug on and on and on with an idea that I thought was shit and eventually make it big. But I've also seen people plug on and on with an idea that I thought was shit and it was just a shit idea.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Ethan and I were talking about this. We were texting about this the other day, right? Like, is it just luck? I think we love to downplay the role of luck in our own lives, all of us, humanity, right? And there's a great book I told Ethan about this, you know, this poker player. And she said all great poker players, when they win, they think it's because they're so great. And when they lose, it's because they had bad luck.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course.
And that's just, that's human nature, right? But it, you know, is it just luck that some people, you know, get it on the 601st audition and some people will never get it, or is there something else to it?
No, I think it's luck. It's hard work. It's determination. I think it is also strategy. Let's not, you know, downplay that. I mean, take, for instance, say Arnold Schwarzenegger, excellent autobiography, not my favorite person, but his book is great.
Sure.
And he realized pretty early on that he was not going to get any roles because he had this weird accent and he was massive at a point where people in the movies were not massive. So he essentially went and became independently wealthy via flipping houses because he realized, you know, if he had some money starting out his career as an actor, he was going to be in a better position.
Yeah.
And then essentially he got the industry to create roles for him. You know, he had this like machine-like accent, so he ended up being perfect for the Terminator. Mm-hmm. Now, that was an example of great strategy. Simply going and doing 300 auditions would have wasted his time. So he was like, okay, I'm going to change my strategy. Where can I use, you know, my downsides as kind of positive. There's no doubt though, luck has impact as well. I think luck probably has more of an impact if you're sort of mildly decent. Like a lot of people who are successful, who are say mildly talented or mildly smart, they probably had a dose of luck,
sure,
or were just particularly determined. Like I think a lot of the people who are just fucking brilliant will kind of get there anyway. But I don't put myself in that group, so I've definitely had a bit of luck along the way.
You know, it's interesting. I love that story because, you know, when I work with clients, like I think, you know, part of what I advise them is only play a game you can win. And it doesn't mean you're guaranteed to win, but there are some games that, you know, the odds are just so against you that you're almost guaranteed to lose. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you're, you know, if you're trying to be independent and you're up against competitors with much bigger budgets and, you know, massive media at their disposal, you can't just go do what they do at a smaller level. You won't get anywhere, right? That you have to, all about strategy. I love that. So,
right. Yeah, you got to like, you know, maximize your strengths rather than trying to fix your weaknesses, which a lot of us also try and do.
Absolutely.
Like work out what you're good at and leverage that.
Yeah.
Great. If you can't win the existing game, then you have to change the game you're playing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think another really important thing though, which comes just on to what you were just saying, Josh, is that also pick something you genuinely love and you're genuinely fucking enthusiastic for, because that will make it much easier to push through those roadblocks. So say for instance, you are an independent businessman or whatever, and you're going up against somebody which has much bigger resources. If you're hoping to beat them in 2 years, probably not gonna happen. However, if you're like, you know what, this is my fucking passion, I want to work on this business every single day for the rest of my fucking life, and even if it's never going to be profitable, I will still be doing it because I love it that much. Those sorts of people are the sort that do eventually end up turning over the kind of Goliath-like competition, just because they're never going to fucking stop. And there's a lot of power in that as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, what does that look like for you today? How do you think about strategy going forward?
I, for the most part, just try and find things that inspire me.
Yeah.
Whether it's making music, editing videos, and I really try and keep the things that I do that are not sort of like creative core business down to a minimum. It's really easy where I am to spend like all of your time doing like social media and stuff like that, and in reality it's a lot less important than we tend to give it credit for. I see so many up and coming artists who have like exceptional social media, but they haven't got really particularly great careers because their music is not good.
Yeah.
And when the main product, i.e. in which in my case is music, is good, everything else does tend to take care of itself. And again, it's leveraging strengths, and my strength is music, rather than trying to fix weaknesses. And for a long time, I would be trying to fix weaknesses in my career rather than leveraging my strengths. And I still fall into that trap from time to time. But
yeah, of course.
Leveraging strengths is where I always try and sort of spend my days.
Yeah, I've found that a lot of times trying to fix the weaknesses rather than leveraging the strengths just draws attention to the weaknesses.
Right, exactly.
So yeah. I have a question for you. So one of the things that you kind of hear a lot in music is like the concept of people selling out and going from, you know, being really proud of being an independent artist and, you know, really like respecting the craft. And then the idea of like, oh, you take the big record label and you sell out and you kind of give up what it meant to you in the beginning. There's kind of this idea that that happens. But the course of your career is in a way kind of the exact opposite, where you've been in the label system for the majority of your career. You worked with Armada for a long time.
Yeah.
And you had your label Garuda with Armada. And now you made a big post on your Instagram before the release of this current album about how, you know, this is your first project where you're fully independent.
Yeah.
I'd love to just kind of hear a little bit about how that process happened and what it's like kind of going the opposite of that course that a lot of people, you know, the kind of course that you typically hear people talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been in what I'd call the true major label game. I mean, Armada, and I've been at Armada since 2015, so about 5 years, but it was still a dance label. So whilst there are some sort of label constraints there, as you get at labels, I could still do my own thing for the most part. I think the main reason for being independent these days is just that if you have a reasonably big audience, given all most of your money is made from, you know, the Spotify's and Apple Music and YouTube and those places, a label better be doing something really fucking good to justify the money you give them.
Sure.
And it mainly came like one of the big reasons was like, firstly, I like having control, and that was fine. I still got plenty of control over there, but it was just looking at the financials and realizing long term just how much money I was giving up by doing it via a record label. And you know, at many parts of my career, like, I just never even thought about money from music. I was like, you know what, music, what it makes, touring's where my money is. Like, I almost wouldn't even look at record deals. It was just whether I felt I was above it or whatever, I was like, you know what, I couldn't give a shit, just get the fucking thing done.
Sure.
And we'll make the money back on the touring side. And over the past 3 or 4 years, all of a sudden streaming music really became an actual source of income, which it really wasn't, you know, a decade ago. And when I actually looked at it, I was like, shit, like, we give away so much money by taking advances. And you know, I'll give you an example, because I think it is interesting for any artist who are sort of dealing with a similar conundrum. So for my last artist album, which was 2016, I don't recall the exact advance, but it was a good advance. It was like 100 grand, something like that. It was a decent fucking amount of money. I was like, fucking 100 grand. Yeah, brilliant. We'll take that. And that got me a royalty rate of about 25% when all was said and done. 75% label, 20% me. But that album has streamed and streamed and streamed, and once it's 10 years old, it would have grossed over $1 million. It's not that far away now.
Sure.
And I looked at the long term and I was like, shit. So over the 10-year period, I essentially took a salary of $10,000 a year to give away $750,000. Like,
right.
If I look at releasing music with any other lens other than the absolute short term, that just makes no fucking sense. So yeah. I was like, it's gotta be independent, unless I just, so yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're sort of betting against yourself, right? You're kind of taking out an insurance policy.
Right. That's going to label, you're banging to yourself, exactly.
Right, because, you know, which is, frankly, not always a bad move, right? Like, well, maybe in principle betting against yourself is a bad move, but having that insurance right there, plenty of artists.
Not if you know you're going to lose, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's plenty of artists that have lived off of advances and, you know, and didn't make enough in that time period to, you know, support themselves had they been living off royalties. But I think, you know, the flip side is, yeah, if you're successful, you overpaid for, you know, some short-term security. And those are hard decisions to make. I mean, I think obviously, you know, you're in the business, Ethan, of giving artists, you know, more options, mm-hmm. you know, to.
But that is something that I deal with every day, of explaining to artists that an advance isn't free money. It's a loan, and it's a loan that is not fun to pay back, you know? So that's always personally like a little bit of a struggle because I try really hard to discourage artists from taking advances, and if they want money, to put it all towards marketing. But it's hard to break the mindset that it's free money, you know?
Sure.
So it's interesting.
Right. And the only way it sort of can be free money is if you're not tied in.
Yeah, you just leave after the release. Yeah.
You leave after the release, you're not going to work with the label again. Okay, right. Then it is kind of free money.
But then you're a label hopper, and that's a reputation.
Yeah, that wears out after a while.
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can't pull that trick too many times.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, you know, like, you've got to fucking pay it back. And some labels these days would also kind of cross recoup tracks against one another.
Sure.
So, and that's what would happen to me with Armada, and they do this. And I think a lot of other labels will do it, but literally there's no point in me taking advances for anything at the end. Cause there's like 30 or 40 of my records that are all being released there. Right. And if I take an advance on a new one, none of those old ones pay me money until the new one is paid off.
That's right.
So, you can get yourself into some kind of sticky situations. Now, I also do think, though, if an advance is going to allow somebody to leave their job, that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. If it's going to allow them, well, maybe it's like not even buy studio equipment because that doesn't cost much these days, but maybe if it's like essential equipment, you know, if it's going
to... If there's a reason to take out a loan, then there's a reason to take out a loan. But you don't just go to the bank and take out a loan when you don't need a loan.
Right.
No, and what you have to remember is the loans the record labels give you are on much less reasonable terms than the loans that the bank would give you.
Sure.
Right.
Like, this isn't like fucking 15% APR. This is like fucking 75% of all the money.
That's right.
Right. I mean, whatever the royalty rate that the label has is what their profit margin will be by the time they've recouped.
Right. Sure. Exactly. And labels are the other thing I realize with labels is they'd offer me, I'll get offered advances and I'll be going, that's fucking crazy. I can't believe you give me so much money. I'll take it. But actually, I hadn't done the maths. They had done the maths.
Right.
It might take them 5 years, it might take them 10 years, but they'll get it back eventually. Even if it takes, and in my records it usually happened pretty fucking quickly, but they knew they were getting it back eventually. And like you say, when they got it back, the margin was very
still a long way to go before you make anything.
Yeah,
still a long way to go before you make anything.
Absolutely.
So yeah, like a lot of it was just down to the financial aspect and realizing that actually, if you release records that do well and you're doing them, you know, independently, those are great fucking assets to have. And as they build up, they will continue to pay you. And of, you know, with sort of independent distribution, like we have with Ethan and the guys at Create, it's, you know, you're kind of getting real-time information of how much money you're making, mm-hmm. As opposed to what you get from labels, which happens twice a year.
Right.
It's a indecipherable multi-thousand, like 2,000 or 3,000 page statement.
Yeah.
Really fucking difficult to know that everything that is correct.
No, they count on nobody reading it. Or
and when you work with a partner that does pay every month and shows you your data real time, it makes you wonder what those other guys are doing and why they're not paying you out every month, you know?
Right.
The capability isn't there.
Sure.
No, because they're seeing stats. in real time.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. For sure.
And they have the ability, and labels do have the ability to present stats in a way that is understandable. They, for the most part, choose not to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't want to come across as anti-label. I'm certainly not. And I think everybody has an amount of money that's like fucking life-changing, right? And like if a major label were to offer me an amount of money that would mean I could essentially live off it for the next fucking 5 years, I'd probably take it, especially now it's unstable times, right? Sure. But yeah, you also, but I would also make sure that I was not handicapping myself or stopping my ability to release music in the future. And I think that's, you do not want to get locked into a label deal, which goes bad and you can't get out and you can't even release your own music.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So what are you most excited about next?
Releasing this new album, it was like spent most of the last year working on it. And it was the first album where I've really written sort of lyrics about my own life. Mm. Since I was in bands, which has been kind of nuts. But for most of my career, I was just the producer, right? Sure. Got songs that were already made, the vocals were already done. And then I just went and you know, produced them. Whereas this time it's been writing songs about my own life, kind of from the top, which is, it made it feel like it's my first album. I think it's got a rawness and a freshness to it that you typically get with like a debut album as opposed to the fourth album, which this actually is. So yeah, I'm fucking excited to get it out there.
Yeah, it's awesome. When is that coming?
July the 10th, I believe.
Nice.
There's a GarethEmery.com, there's a pre-save and all that shit there if anyone wants to go and check it out.
Cool.
But the song You'll Be Okay is already out, and you should check it out now.
You'll Be Okay is already out, yeah. And the next one, release, comes out in about 10 days.
If you're enjoying this one, actually, Ethan Baer was a guest on the show back in 2018. Ethan was also the co-founder of EDM.com, an important media outlet in the world of electronic music, and he tells us his journey as an entrepreneur, making his way through music, starting a company, all kind of crazy shit that he's gone through. So go back and check that one out.
So I got to get to a little lightning round before we let you off the hook.
Yeah.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
Singapore or Vancouver. It used to be Los Angeles, but then I moved here, so sure. I don't count anymore.
Yeah. No, that's great. I actually haven't been to either one of those. You, Ethan?
I have not.
Amazing, amazing cities.
Add those to the list.
Singapore's kind of like Asia light, and I love Asia in general. I'm a big sort of like
Asia light.
Yeah,
I get like it. They speak English.
Speak English, it's like super clean.
Yeah.
And Vancouver is just one of the most pleasant cities you'll find in North America with amazing people and beautiful scenery.
Cool.
Yeah, I've heard great things about Vancouver.
That's really good city.
Who's your favorite DJ?
Oof. Ashley Warbridge, maybe? No, not Ashley. Oh, like I like Hot Intake 2, Loco Dice, Eric Pritz, one of those three.
Okay.
I'll give you one more actually. If I had to go and listen to a set now, Solomon.
Okay.
Mm.
Awesome. What's the last great book you read?
I'm currently reading, quite appropriately, Love in the Time of Cholera.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a classic. I'm about halfway through, and it's so far is deserving its classic status. It's very, very, very good.
That sounds very intense.
No, it really isn't. It's surprisingly light. Another one I recommend is by David Benioff, who was one of the creators of Game of Thrones. Mm. And the book is called City of Thieves. It's fucking excellent. That was probably the last great book I read, I think.
It's funny. I've been thinking about a book. I've just been thinking about a title of Love in the Time of Coronavirus.
Love in the Time of Coronavirus.
Yeah. And like, there's an interesting story there. I'm not the one to write it. But, you know, back to what we were saying earlier about what it means for dating right now.
Right, exactly.
What movie have you seen the most in your life?
Um, It would be one of a couple of my personal favorites, Lost in Translation.
What a great movie.
Incredible movie. A lot of people don't get it.
Really?
A lot of people, but nothing happens. And I'm like, yeah, that is one of the most transportive movies I've ever, I travel a lot. I watch that movie and I feel like I've been to Tokyo and I've lived, I don't know. I feel like I've lived that movie.
Well, I mean, I love that movie. I feel like you can probably relate to that in a different way, right? Because, it's about this guy that's off by himself, bored to death, getting paid.
It's quite close to my life in many, many ways.
Imagine. Oh, that's cool. Just a
masterfully restrained and beautiful movie. I'm going to have to try and put it on later. Mm. I've seen Pulp Fiction many times. And also a collection of... I'll tell you a guilty pleasure. We'll jump back. Fucking Disney movies, man. Some of them are so good. And I never would have watched them until I had kids.
So like what?
Frozen 2 is good. But the one... Coco is an absolute barnstormer. Have you heard of it?
I have. I have a son that watches all that shit. But I have not seen it.
Coco is really good. It's about the Mexican Day of the Dead.
Oh, I did see it.
The Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah, yeah. That's so funny.
You seen it?
I have a 10-year-old son who watches all that shit. So
okay. If you're going to sit down and watch Coco with him, that one's fucking good.
All right. What style from your past are you glad is behind you and not on social media?
Fashion style, it would be Candy Raver.
Okay.
Spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
Personal style, I'm just not being a fucking asshole. And I think if you grow up with never having much money, not that we were poor, but we never had much, and then like all of a sudden you start making shitloads of money being a DJ, you're probably going to turn into a fucking asshole. And I certainly did for a while. And I'm kind of glad that sort of the worst excesses of that time are not stored on the internet.
So what's the dumbest thing you bought when you first got some money?
I could list so many things. probably a Rolls Royce was the worst one. It was the dumbest thing I bought. I also bought a Lamborghini, but that wasn't dumb. It also lost me a lot of money.
Sure.
But I'd wanted one since I was 10 years old. I was getting it. It took me 20 years. I finally got one. So I didn't really beat myself up for that. But then I sold the Lamborghini to buy something more practical and decided to buy a Rolls Royce. And that was
which is arguably less practical.
Yeah, not that correct.
It was more practical on the road, less practical for the bank account. Mm. And at one point, this thing was depreciating at about 10 grand a month.
Yeah.
At one point, I didn't drive it for 6 weeks because I was on tour. And I came home, and just to give the thing a run out, I went and got a burger. And I was sitting after I was eating my burger, I was like, this is literally a $15,000 burger because it's the only trip the car's taken.
That's awesome.
And I sold the Rolls Royce shortly after that.
Sure. Not to wrap your head around the idea of exponential depreciation, right?
Yeah, that was the Rolls Royce was probably the single worst loss of money that I've had, I think.
I think it's a brand you're sort of forgiven for that.
Yeah, I mean, great fucking cars. I mean, I don't know another one. They just need to make them cheaper.
I don't think they're planning on that.
But guys at Rolls Royce, if you're watching, like, go and check the model the Toyota have got, because they build good cars and they're completely affordable. Like, if you do that, everyone will be buying your cars.
We'll send this to them. If you could wake up tomorrow having gained any quality or ability, what would it be?
Oof. See, I was going to say immortality because I'm like a bit of a hypochondriac, so I do have a irrational fear of illness. But then immortality would suck.
Yeah.
If like I think all my family.
That fear forever.
Yeah, but all my family died and stuff.
You gotta live through everyone you care about dying forever.
Yeah, that sucks. So how, like, okay, so immortality, like up to the age of like 80, that would be all right. Or like, or maybe even 90. So just go like, you're good until then. Nobody can kill you. You can do whatever you want and you will not die.
That's just good luck, right?
but then on the eve of your 90th birthday, go to bed, game over. That would be pretty cool.
That's pretty badass. That's definitely, I think, the most interesting answer anyone's given to that question.
I had to sort of like get there along the way by thinking.
No, out that's really cool. I love it.
Yeah.
What's the last thing you stole?
Ooh, that is.
It's a shit question because no one can remember.
Yeah, and like for the most part, I do try and avoid stealing in any sense. Like even like generally speaking, I always try and do like the right thing. You know, I like, even if like a restaurant like leaves items off the bill, like I'll tell them you left these items off the bill. And so even though it'd be debatable whether that is stealing or not,
sure.
I've definitely stolen items of food from an airport lounge. There are quite strict rules that the items are being consumed in the lounge and not with you. But I've definitely shoved a few cookies in my bag.
It's a victimless crime.
Yeah.
What a criminal.
Ethan, what's the last thing you stole? Now that you've had a couple of minutes to think about that.
The last thing I stole. The last thing I stole, I don't know if I would call it stealing, but I would say it was sort of stealing. About 5 weeks ago, I had lost a pair of AirPods and I got into an Uber and there was a pair of AirPods sitting on the seat.
Oh, shit.
And I pocketed them. I was like, I lost mine. You lose some, you find some.
Wow. So I actually lost a pair of AirPod Pro.
Oh, sure you did, huh?
not an Uber.
That'd be amazing.
You're off the hook there. Although that really, I should have been like, yeah, it was an Uber. Nah, on the way back from my last Asia tour, which was just when Corona was kicking off, and I was on a plane wearing my N95 mask and also wearing my AirPods. And the plane gets in the air, and I'm like, yeah, it's safe to take the mask off now. So I take off the mask and a little bit of elastic, literally, they just catapult these plugs, bang, and they fly all the way down the back of the plane. Both of them.
That's
it was crazy. Like, I could not have done it that well if I'd tried to. And they were, in an instant, they were gone. I knew what had happened. And I was like, you know what? It's a fully laden fucking 747 in the time of coronavirus. There's no way I'm going down the back of the plane on my hands and knees looking for my AirPods.
No way.
I'm just going to let them go and hopefully I'll find another pair in the back of Uber.
Don't worry, I'm a DJ.
Another terrible thing about coronavirus.
Yeah.
My last question, if I worked for you, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
I'm going to be late. running 10 minutes late.
That's cool. I mean, just giving people a heads up is great.
Yeah, I always give a heads up, and whilst I do agree that I'm great for giving that heads up, I would potentially be greater by just being on time.
Yeah.
You know what?
My favorite is when people let you know they're going to be late when it's clear based on when they're letting you know that they still have time to make it on time and they're just choosing not to.
That's funny.
Oh, yeah.
They tell you the day before.
Yeah, I'm going to be late, by the way. Traffic.
No, it is often a choice. And like usually it's not, so I just will plan my time badly. But sometimes I do try and do like a daily like meditation and stuff, which just stops me from going nuts, like particularly now. And sometimes I'll realize like I've planned my day badly and the only time I'm going to get to do it is before a call. And I'll be like, you know what, I'm going to be 10 minutes late, even it might be an hour in advance, just so I can get in my 20-minute meditation. Because I know the call will also probably go better if I've done that, before. So, but yeah, punctuality, that would also be a superpower that would be useful to have.
So I spend...
Punctuality is a great superpower.
I spent many years being late for everything. And then I read Michael Ovitz's autobiography.
Yep.
You know, he's the founder of CIA, CAA. And yep.
I've heard that's a really good book.
It's great. And one of the stories was that he was absolutely never late. And on the rare occasion that he was even 1 minute late, he would kind of have a formal apology. And I remember reading that and going, you know what? If that fucking guy can be on time, I guess I should be on time for things. And I'm not late anymore on rare occasion. Yeah, and
in the six, 7 years I've known you, I don't know if I've ever known you to be late to anything.
No, I'm not. And, you know, once in a while it happens and I apologize and I make, you know, more of it than sometimes people are like, what are you talking about? You're not late. It's only 10 minutes. And you know, we're definitely in a culture where everyone's overscheduled, and certainly in our industry, it's artists especially are expected to be late. You know, for me, that just reading that a guy like that could make that a priority was impactful.
I think it's, I need to read that book. I think it's...
Yeah, it's a great book.
It's really good. I definitely think being an artist has allowed me to get away with more than I probably should have been allowed.
Of course.
Because you're kind of allowed to. What I will say is, though, I am never, ever late on stage unless something completely out of my control, like a plane has just landed late and we've rushed. Like, and I have changed my clothes in disabled toilets in, you know, in Portaloos and whatever to make sure I get on stage on time. And I approach that pretty seriously.
Yeah, that's big. I've been to shows where the artists, you know, showed up 2-3 hours late, I think on purpose, and it sucks.
Well, it's hard to ever look at an artist the same again when that's happened to you and you feel like they've like disrespected you as a fan.
Yeah, absolutely. But
I've also seen a lot of artists go on stage late when they arrived at the venue on time, but they were just having a fucking drink or talking to a mate or something. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I just don't want to go on yet. Like, what are you doing? Like, your obligation is to the people that have paid.
Right. It's like, realize this is your job, right?
So I'll tell you a quick story since you're an Ice Cube fan. In the 90s, I was managing rappers.
And
I managed a guy called Dub C, who was in West Side Connection with Ice Cube. Yeah. So there was three of them. And they all had separate managers, and they came together for this kind of super group. And so we were headlining the radio festival in San Francisco, Summer Jam. And so we all, you know, flew up and we're checked into a hotel and whatever, and we're supposed to leave at 4 o'clock or whatever to go to the venue. And the three of them sent their tour managers down to the lobby. They kept going down to check and see if anyone else was down there because no one wanted to be the first one to go get in the limos to the show because it's like a power thing.
And
we spent an hour and a half sitting in the hotel room doing absolutely nothing, watching TV, waiting until someone else was the first one to go down and be ready for the show. 90 minutes.
That is, and were they on stage on time or they just didn't want to be hanging around at the venue?
I think they were like 30 minutes late or they were a little bit late on stage. But, you know, but meanwhile, everything was a big rush after that because we had to, you know, rush and get there and all that. It was crazy, but that's, you know, they're certainly not the only ones that have done shit like that.
Yeah, I don't get that. And I think being late, especially when it comes to a show, does put a lot of pressure and a lot of stress on people around you.
Oh, yeah.
And I sort of know that I will create pressure and stress for the team around me by arriving late to the venue. Like, they'd really like me like an hour before. I'll sometimes turn up like 15 minutes before. Uh-huh. But like, I will know that that is not going to impact my ability to be on stage on time. I might miss like a meet and greet or something and have to push that till after the show.
Sure.
But the only standard I sort of hold myself to is like, I want my 2 feet on stage at the exact time my set's starting. And even to the point where, even if a promoter is like, you know what, I want to change things around a bit, we've got some extra production, we're going to start you 15 minutes late, I'll be like, if it's all right, I'd rather start on time. Like, Do not like on stage.
Yeah, that's cool. That's great. Well, man, thanks for doing this. It's so much fun talking with you.
Absolutely, pleasure.
Love it. This is our first
great, man.
Three-way video conference. Appreciate you rolling with it.
It's been good fun. And let's do it again sometime.
Nice. Yeah, well, we'll have to do it when we can meet up in person.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
So if you could leave your fans with one thought about the new album, what would you tell them?
Other than please listen to it on repeat while you sleep. Nah, it's just the most honest. It's the most honest thing I've ever made. It's the hardest I've ever worked on an album,
nice.
By far. And I think the results will show. So get it, listen to it. And I also think it's made for a time like now. And I think we couldn't be releasing it at a better moment. I'm not, obviously none of us are glad of these circumstances, but like this album is one that's made for getting people through tough times. So get hold of it.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Can't wait to hear.
Amazing.
Nice. Thank you.
That was Gareth Emery on Rebel Radio with my co-host Ethan Bear. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you leave us a comment on Twitter, on Facebook. Everything is at Rebel Radio Net. We have videos of a lot of our episodes showing up on our YouTube page at Rebel Radio Net. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.